In the wake of 9/11, the United States officially launched two wars in Afghanistan and Iraq, plus a number of secret conflicts around the globe, which you rarely hear about. In his new book, Dirty Wars, The World is a Battlefield, Jeremy Scahill delves into the murky world of our covert campaigns, the people running them, and those who end up caught in the crossfire. It's published by Nation Books, and his work is also the subject of a documentary also called Dirty Wars, which opens June 7th. It's always a pleasure to welcome him back to our show. Hi, Jeremy.
It's great to be with you.
You describe a global and largely secret set of wars being waged by the United States. Where are most of these wars being fought?
On the Horn of Africa, the Arabian Peninsula, in countries like the Philippines and Indonesia. And then there's a covert war within the larger conventional war in Afghanistan.
What kinds of actions do most of these campaigns involve? Are we talking about drone strikes mostly, or funding militants?
Well, you know, the issue of drones has really become it's almost sort of like Kleenex to facial tissue, you know, where like drones has sort of come to embody the kill program. But what I show in the book is that in reality, much of these covert actions has nothing to do with drones. It's cruise missile strikes that are launched from submarines in the sea, and they're very devastating weapons, but also using proxy forces in countries like Somalia, where we have warlords on the payroll, propping up militaries like the Yemeni military and its elite counterterrorism forces, and then sending in teams of SEALs to do raids like the one that was done against Osama bin Laden, but you'll never hear about it, and reporters aren't certainly embedded with those units.
The subtitle of your book is The World is a Battlefield. Can you talk about the origins of the idea that a country can strike anywhere, even in places where we're not officially at war? I mean, this is not new, is it?
Right.
Hasn't the United States been running covert campaigns
From the
ever since
time,
I can remember?
Yeah, exactly, right. First of all, the title of the book, Dirty Wars, there were sort of two reasons I chose that. One is because I think that under the Obama administration, a lot of liberals are sort of believing that we're waging clean wars, that the drones are going in and surgically picking off the leadership of al-Qaeda. And certainly that has happened. I mean, Obama himself likes to say, ask the 22, you know, al-Qaeda leaders that we've taken out if I have resolve, you know, in the Republicans.
Are we running out of top al-Qaeda leaders?
Yeah, I mean, the number three guy has been killed, I think, 15 times this year. There's one militant that I write about in Somalia who's one of the leaders of AQAP, al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula, named Syed al-Shiri. And I think under the Obama administration, he's been killed, I think it's 13 times. A couple of weeks ago, he was killed for, I think, the 13th time this year. But the idea of dirty wars, though, is that there really isn't a such thing as a clean war. And it seems almost like, it should be obvious, but that's true. But then also it reminds me, and I'm glad that you brought up about haven't we been doing this since the beginning of time, of the dirty wars that the Reagan and Bush administration was fueling in Central America in the 1980s, and also a lot of what the CIA was involved with in its early stages. So one of the theses of my book is that we're kind of getting back to this era where it's not large-scale deployments, but using a lot of proxy forces and covert action.
But in the past, it was all about toppling unfriendly governments, whether it was in Guatemala or Nicaragua or Iran,
right.
Or propping up
governments like Pinochet in Chile. And of course, you know, the CIA was involved with its fair share of assassinations.
But we're not doing that anymore, are we?
Well, I mean, if you look at what happened in Yemen under the Obama administration, the Obama administration hung on to the bloody end to defend that dictator at a time when he was getting a lot of money and counterterrorism support from the U.S. and was turning it on his own people. On the issue of overthrowing governments, I mean, of course, Muammar Gaddafi was a ruthless thug, but the United States did overthrow his regime effectively by using air power and covert support on the ground.
On the other hand, with Saddam Hussein, we both supported him,
right,
at one point, and then toppled him at another point.
Yeah, I spent many years going in and out of Iraq. I spent time in Saddam's Iraq. And you know, what I have come to the conclusion that the U.S. has been sort of consistent in its policy toward Iraq. It's been consistently sort of anti-Iraqi civilian. At a time when Saddam was at his most brutal, you know, Rumsfeld is giving him a gift of golden cowboy spurs from Reagan and taking him off the list of state sponsors of terror. Then, you know, when the United States overthrows Saddam Hussein, we go in and just created this horrid situation. Look at every day If you watch CNN, all this coverage of Boston and tiny little print in the ticker, 27 people killed in a bombing in a Baghdad cafe. I mean, it's like a footnote of history now. And today the Bush Library is launched and no discussion of what we did to Iraq.
It was announced today that the U.S. government is now claiming Assad has used chemical weapons in Syria. Do we have any covert actions currently in Syria?
Yes, absolutely. I mean, there are small teams of U.S. Special Operations Forces and the CIA that are giving support to Syrian rebel groups. And I think this is a story that it may take a year or two to come out, but I think we're going to see that there was a lot more going on than we are led to believe right now.
Now, those Special Operations Forces, they come under the command of JSOC.
Yeah, the Joint Special Operations.
And you're right, a lot about JSOC here. Until the Bin Laden raid, many Americans hadn't even heard of JSOC. When was it formed?
JSOC is a fascinating story. It was formed in 1980 out of the ashes of the failed hostage rescue mission in Iran. And that, you know, that was, if you look at the history of that, and we don't need to get into it right now.
It was a great embarrassment for
Jimmy Carter.
Horrible
embarrassment for Jimmy Carter. And there were actual, and I have a chapter on this in my book, actual military units fighting with each other during this unbelievably chaotic situation in which a number of servicemen died. And they decided to create a unified command that was like an all-star team of the most elite forces in the U.S. military. And so you had SEAL Team 6 was developed. At the time, there were only two SEAL teams, but they developed the idea of SEAL Team 6 to throw the Soviets off and make them think that we had a larger capacity Delta Force, and then this elite air unit called the Night Stalkers. And from 1980 until 9/11, that force sort of was only whispered about in hushed tones at the Pentagon, and they were involved with all sorts of stuff in Latin America and elsewhere, but it wasn't really a publicly known entity.
But drawn from the various armed forces?
Absolutely.
The Navy, the Marines,
right.
The Army.
Yeah, they wanted to have a full spectrum capability, so if you wanted to do an amphibious assault, they also have an intelligence division. The best helicopter pilots in the world work for JSOC.
So they have capabilities to do pretty much anything. Can they really strike anywhere in the world in just a few hours?
Yeah. I mean, for instance, I'll give you there's a great story early on in Obama's first term in April of 2009. These Somali pirates had hijacked a U.S.-flagged vessel, the Maersk Alabama. I think it was the first time a U.S. ship had been hijacked like that in 100 years. And President Obama authorized a team of SEALs to go in and take out the pirates. And the SEALs deployed from a previously unknown base in Lamu, Kenya, where JSOC had a base called Camp Simba. And so they staged it off of the coast of Kenya.
And one of the people you spoke to described JSOC as a paramilitary arm of the White House.
Yeah.
So is this his, President Obama's? Was it President Bush's as well? Private
Absolutely.
Little army?
Right. Yeah. And it was President Reagan's and President Bush's. But for the most part, they were used for very discreet counterterrorism missions. If there were ever kidnapping situations of U.S. diplomats or military figures, which actually did happen during the Cold War, JSOC would be used. The reason that I think that this guy, this special operator who spoke to me, said that is because there's very limited congressional involvement with anything that JSOC does. And the purpose of JSOC is to be used in a manner that is never going to really grab headlines, certainly not in real time.
Who funds it? Does it just come out of the regular military budget?
It's a black budget. I mean, there are certain aspects of the Special Operations Command budget that are published and are made public to the American people. But much of what happens in the name of JSOC is only briefed to a closed hearing of certain members of the Senate Armed Services Committee.
My guest is Jeremy Scahill, national security correspondent for The Nation magazine and author of the New York Times bestseller, Blackwater, The Rise of the World's Most Powerful Mercenary Army. His latest book, Dirty Wars, The World is a Battlefield. It is published by Nation Books. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. And according to your sources, JSOC teams have been deployed by President Obama alone to Iran, Georgia, Ukraine, Bolivia, Paraguay, Peru, Yemen, Pakistan, the Philippines. Why are we sending JSOC forces? What else?
Colombia.
Yeah, well, why are we sending JSOC forces to places in South America?
Right. I mean, in some cases, they're fighting against drug lords. They've given support also to special units in Mexico hunting down drug cartel leaders. In some cases, they're looking at connections between international drug cartels and international terrorist organizations. Their mandate is to do counterproliferation, which is a lot of what they're doing. doing in Iran and Pakistan and counterterrorism. Before 9/11, the counterterrorism issue was not the sort of premier thing that we thought about when we think of threats to the homeland. And so the mission scope has expanded quite dramatically.
Well, is this a bad thing? It sounds to me that this is many of these operations are a lot more commendable than trying to topple an elected government that we don't like.
I mean, I think what President Obama discovered when he learned that he had this capability early on is that it was sort of a backdoor way of carrying out policies in a very politicized world that wouldn't get much scrutiny. And so to me, the issue you ask about, is it good or bad? When we're talking about the threat of drug cartels in Mexico, you can view it through a militarized lens and say the way to do it is to go in, and, like we did with Bin Laden, and take them out. Or you could ask other deeper questions about why there's a drug war. And so, you know, if your goal is to kill drug cartel leaders, yeah, that's your policy. But if your goal is to say why is this an actual war, then you have to have a different dialogue.
Early in his political career, Barack Obama described the Iraq campaign as a dumb war by using targeted killings and strikes of this sort. Is he attempting to wage a smart war?
Well, I think that he and Vice President Biden's been a very influential figure in this, too. I think that they basically said, we want to get away from what the Bush folks were doing, and they campaigned on that idea. And I think that they believe they're doing a more efficient way of waging war that's not going to result in a lot of American body bags coming home.
And also, by going against al-Qaeda affiliates in places like Yemen or Somalia, using this kind of tactic, it said we're using a scalpel instead of a sledgehammer.
Right, and I mean, you know, that's the way that it's presented, and I think a lot of guys in that community like to think that that's what it is. But you know, when you do a drone strike on a village under the guise of what's called a signature strike, where you're attacking a group of people based on the fact that they're military age males, they happen to be in a certain region of Yemen, and they had a pattern of associating with various figures, and you say these people preemptively must be terrorists, and then you go in and kill them. That's pre-crime. You know, we don't know the identities of them. We don't actually have any actual evidence that they've done anything. And then we kill them. We're creating a situation where I believe we're going to have blowback. So it's not surgical. And I use the phrase targeted killing myself, but I actually wish I didn't, because it's in many cases, it's not actually that targeted.
And we're seeing that kind of blowback, especially in Pakistan, where the general American newspaper reader, we have killed some terrorists. To the Pakistanis, we have killed a lot of innocent people and are just ignoring the so-called collateral damage.
Right. I mean, you remember in December of 2009 when there was this suicide bombing that happened at Forward Operating Base Chapman in Afghanistan, where this triple agent, Jamal al-Badawi, blew himself up and killed a number of CIA people and Blackwater people. That was in part response to the drone bombing campaign in Pakistan. But normally, when acts of terrorism take place, they're not aimed at the military. They're not aimed at entities of the U.S. government. They kill civilians. And so, I mean, just as a person, taking off my journalism cap for a second, I'm concerned that we are going to increase the threat to ordinary Americans traveling abroad or traveling on our own subways.
Well, who's in the driver's seat here? Is it the White House that's pushing all these secret campaigns? Or is President Obama simply signing off on what people in the military and clandestine services want?
There's these conspiracy theories about how, you know, President Obama is sort of being manipulated by the military and that the generals are telling him what to do. This is an incredibly sophisticated guy who really does grasp the power of the forces under him. And I think
can he use it on Congress?
You know, what's amazing is that Obama and his guys will like go to the mat to try to make, sort of lefty Democrats get in line on their military spending stuff. But then when it comes to fighting the Republicans on some of these core issues, it's like, where is that Obama? But you ask a good question. I think the key figure in all of this is a guy named Admiral William McRaven, who is the current commander of all special operations forces. He's the SOCOM commander, Special Operations Command. And President Obama, from very early on in his administration, trusted Admiral McRaven, who was the JSOC commander when President Obama came into power. He led the raid on Osama bin Laden. He had been an original member of SEAL Team 6 in 1980. And when 9/11 happened, he had a back injury from a parachute accident. McRaven was invited into the White House early on after 9/11 by General Wayne Downing and advised the National Security Council when they were creating the high-value targeting campaign to respond to 9/11. So he learned, in addition to being this elite covert warrior, he learned how the White House worked from the front row early on after 9/11. He now is the most trusted military figure of the White House and is running the expansion of all these covert wars.
Some other names pop up. Stanley McChrystal, he was also head of JSOC.
General Stanley McChrystal was very close to Vice President Cheney. was tapped to be the JSOC commander in 2003, and he ran this incredible killing campaign in Iraq. He also was involved with secret prisons that the U.S. had in Iraq, not Abu Ghraib, but another prison called Camp Nama, which stood for Nasty A Military Area. You can't say the word on the air, I don't think. And it was a place where they were taking all of the people they categorized as high value early on, and there was horrid acts of torture committed at this camp. We know about Abu Ghraib, but there are other prisons that were run by these guys that are never talked about.
So is it your sense that JSOC and some of these other campaigns can spin out of control?
Absolutely. I mean, I think that we have a very empowered Special Operations Command. And the CIA is trying to re-paramilitarize itself. You know, the CIA was a paramilitary entity in many ways early on in its career. Then you had the scandals that culminated in a bunch of congressional hearings in the 70s.
And the Church Committee.
And the Church Committee, of course. And then the House Committee on Political Assassination, which was more looking at domestic assassination. But you had a number of people that grew up and are now in key positions in the CIA feeling that covert action is going to get you in trouble with Congress. And they kind of tried to steer away from it being paramilitarized. Now the CIA has watched the incredible rise in strength of the military special operations forces and says, well, if they're going to get into our game of intelligence, we're going to get back into the paramilitary game.
This is the subject of Mark Mazzetti's book as well.
And I have a lot of respect for Mark Mazzetti, and I encourage people, my publisher would probably kill me, but I encourage people to read Mark Mazzetti's book, The Way of the Knife. And,
well, people can read two books.
And of course. And Gregory Johnson wrote a fantastic book about Yemen called The Last Refuge. There's a lot of great journalism being done on this right now.
You mentioned assassinations in recent years. The fact that the United States government maintains an assassination list has come to light. Hasn't it been rebranded as a high-value target list?
Right. It's sort of an Orwellian, you know, it's kind of Orwell light that we develop these terms. And the reason they won't call it assassination is because technically every president since Gerald Ford has issued an updated and executive order that says the United States does not engage in assassinations. And every president has figured out a way around it. You know, President Clinton tried to kill Saddam Hussein in 1993 in a cruise missile attack after reports that they tried to assassinate George H.W. Bush. President Clinton, was very aggressive in trying to take out specific leaders.
He wound up destroying an aspirin factory, if I remember correctly.
Well, they hit in Sudan. Yeah, correct, in Sudan. And also the first orders to kill bin Laden were actually issued under the Clinton administration. But Richard Clark, and I write about this in the book, who is a senior counterterrorism advisor of many presidents, said that if you look at the Clinton-era orders, it was almost like they were Talmudic in structure, because it was like, we only can conduct this operation if you know the brand of doorknob on the house that you want to launch the cruise missile. And now it's just like, they're meeting on Tuesdays to decide who dies and lives.
And Clinton was criticized for taking it, for playing it too safely.
Right. I mean, Jimmy Carter basically, if you look at the current historical context, Jimmy Carter was basically Mahatma Gandhi. And, Bill Clinton was sort of like this, reluctant liberal who occasionally wanted to conduct military operations. I mean, when in reality they were, for their times, quite hawkish. But, you know, compared to Obama, they were very, very much dovish.
Do we know how many people are currently on this high value target list?
No. No,
I mean, it's expanded, you're saying.
It most certainly has expanded. I mean, you know, this guy Matthew Ho, who was a former senior diplomat in Afghanistan, who resigned. He resigned in protest of what was happening in Afghanistan. He was a former combat Marine and a very well-respected guy. At one point, he said there were 2,000 people in Afghanistan alone that were on this Joint Priorities Effects List, which is the JPEL, which is the kill list in Afghanistan. So at least 2,000 there. And all the leadership of these affiliate organizations around the world. But how far down the chain does it go? We're killing propagandists in some cases. And, I wonder why they're on the kill list.
Well, I want to come back to that, just who qualifies to be on this list. And we will address that in many of the other issues you talk about in this book. It's a rather thick book, so there's a lot to get through, and we're not going to.
It doubles as a table. You know, I actually ate dinner on my book last night. I was kind of, and the knife doesn't cut all the way through it.
Over 600 pages. It's called Dirty Wars: The World is a Battlefield, and it's published by Nation Books. My guest is Jeremy Scahill. Stay with us. We are back with Jeremy Scahill, who is the national security correspondent for The Nation magazine. His latest book is Dirty Wars: The World is a Battlefield, published by Nation Books. Let's get back
to... You had asked me about the world as a battlefield, and I actually never answered that because it's an interesting story. It's not my phrase. The world as a battlefield comes from an idea that's actually in military doctrine. It's called operational preparation of the battle space. And the idea is that if the U.S. military determines that there's the potential for a military conflict in a country, it can forward deploy troops. And there's very minimal congressional oversight of those deployments. And the Bush people declared the world a battlefield and basically said, we're preparing for war everywhere. So that's how they justified sending these troops in.
Now, how do you forward deploy troops? Because you have to get the cooperation of neighboring countries, don't you?
In theory.
Or is everybody just on a ship getting as close as possible?
Well, no. I mean, one of the interesting things about these, you know, in the words of Stephen Cambone, these sort of special operations forces is that they can assume identities of other individuals within the U.S. government. They can pose as other. They can be undercover. And they can discreetly go into countries and wear civilian clothes. So some of it might be doing surveillance. Some of it might be doing the first two Fs of something called F-cubed, find, fix, finish, where you find a target, you fix the location, you finish them off. But what happened under Stanley McChrystal when he was running JSOC during the period of the Iraq War is he started to set up these liaison offices in a number of countries around the world, and he would sort of discreetly position his men. They also attach themselves to embassies.
And Raymond Davis, who was a CIA operative in Pakistan and got in a lot of trouble, is an example of that?
Well, Raymond Davis, you know, there's been a lot in the public domain. One of the things I report in the book that hasn't been discussed is that Raymond Davis was, of course, working with Blackwater. He was working as a CIA contractor on its global response staff.
He wasn't really a government official. He was working – he was a hired gun, in effect, wasn't he?
Right. He was a contractor, which a lot of the – you know, Blackwater in its current form, Academy, continues to work for the CIA doing this kind of work. In fact, the guys that were killed in Libya had a history of working with Blackwater also, the former SEALs that were killed in Benghazi. Raymond Davis, though, is in Pakistan. He's working for the CIA as a contractor. He was approached by people from JSOC and asked to essentially freelance for them on the side. So he was working for both the CIA and JSOC in Pakistan. It's a real mystery as to what he was actually doing there. Maybe it was targeting the terrorist group Lashkar-e-Taiba. Maybe it had something to do with Pakistani nukes.
But wouldn't he have had justification in fearing for his life when he was stopped?
Of course. You know, just so people remember the story, that Raymond Davis shot two Pakistanis in Lahore when he was stuck in traffic. The official story and Raymond Davis's story is that these were two guys that were tailing him. He had stopped to get money out of an ATM. He believed that they were going to rob him, that one of them had pulled a gun and was menacing him, and that he shot them in self-defense. The other side of the story, which has been put forward by Pakistanis and by witnesses, is that these guys were sort of just innocently at this stoplight, and Davis pulls out his weapon and starts going after them. Hidden within this spy game is the great possibility that they were from the ISI. And that they were, you know, the Pakistani intelligence service, and that they were tracking Raymond Davis, which Pakistan does with a lot of our spies there, and the U.S. does with spies from other countries that are here. So I don't know. I don't think we even know a small fraction of what happened with Raymond Davis.
Well, in the case of Pakistan, it gets very confusing because we hear that the Pakistani military and the ISI sometimes supports terrorist groups at the same time that those terrorist groups have been attacking the Pakistani government and Pakistani people. And obviously, Pakistan allows the United States to operate despite the fact that it's constantly protesting about that.
Right. I mean, I think I said something in my book to the effect of, you know, that it's a relationship built on, you know, dishonesty, mistrust, and cooperation. You know, it's like all three things at the same time. But so what, you know, the Pakistani government has been deeply implicated in supporting terror groups in Pakistan and also groups that have attacked India. You know, there's very serious questions about the role of Pakistani intelligence in the Mumbai attacks, you know, which a devastating siege in India. And so the United States has its operatives in this tinderbox inside of Pakistan. And the Davis case, remember the timing of this. Raymond Davis was in a Pakistani prison right when the United States was preparing to raid the compound in Abbottabad, Pakistan, to kill Osama bin Laden. They needed to get him out of there. You know, something that also is interesting, Leon Panetta, when he was confronted by the Pakistanis about Raymond Davis, said he's not one of ours. And because if he had, the whole thing would have been resolved. If we said from the beginning he's CIA. So they all were going with the idea that he was a diplomat. Part of the reason is that I don't think that Panetta was aware of Davis's presence. And it's that Davis may have had a much stronger relationship with JSOC than previously known.
I want to get back to that kill list. Well, first of all, why is it a kill list? Wouldn't it be better if we captured some of these people and brought them up to trial? Wouldn't that actually work to the benefit of U.S. propaganda?
Yeah, not just U.S. propaganda. I mean, you know, if you talk, I talk to people who say from the intelligence and special ops community who don't care for me very much and consider me sort of a liberal, a naive liberal that doesn't understand the world. I actually don't consider myself a liberal, but I like to say I'm not a Democrat or Republican. I'm a journalist and equal opportunity critic. But they talk to me because a lot of these guys don't like Blackwater. So I've had this relationship as a result of my Blackwater work with this community. And I've talked to people who are very critical of the kill program because they believe we're losing an opportunity to get actual intelligence. If you cap, like we have this kid in Boston right now, and I refuse to say anything of substance about it because all it is leaks right now. We don't know who this kid is or what his motivations were for anything. But if you have him in custody and you're able to talk to him and get information and intelligence out of him, You then have the potential to find out things that can save American lives later if there are other plots or whatever. If you just go and you kill people, then you learn nothing about it. You learn nothing about what's going on. We have a dearth of intelligence in Yemen right now.
Are most of the people on the kill list connected to al-Qaeda?
Well, we don't know who's on the kill list, which is one of the problems. I mean, when Senator Ron Wyden of Oregon and unfortunately Senator Rand Paul has been fairly good on this issue, when they've tried to ask for information on this, the White House has been very, very secretive. It's almost like trying to find out if you're on the no-fly list. It's just you won't find out until you know. And in the case of the kill list, you won't find out until a Hellfire missile blows you up. So,
well, but there have been congressional hearings on this, haven't there?
Well, and there was a Senate hearing the other day where this young Yemeni man, Faraya al-Muslimi, who I knew in Yemen, came and testified about his village being bombed a week before he came to testify in front of Congress. But there's actually been very few hearings that have addressed any of the core issues of this.
Because Congress is uncomfortable dealing with this? Look like it was going against a program to protect Americans?
I think part of it is that the Obama administration, really has in general refused to even use the word drone or acknowledge this publicly. Brennan had to. They had to leak that white paper from the Department of Justice before Brennan's CIA confirmation hearing so that Brennan would be able to talk about something and not just be saying no comment the whole time.
The White House declined to send a representative to the hearings yesterday.
Did. This administration has, on this issue, has totally lacked anything vaguely resembling transparency, and at the same time has really waged an unprecedented war against whistleblowers.
Is the administration providing reports to Congress over what we're currently engaged in Somalia in the fight against the radical group al-Shabaab?
The administration sends this sort of boilerplate note to Congress every once in a while, and the Bush administration did the same thing, where it's informing Congress that the U.S. is engaged in activities in countries such as Somalia. And they've listed
Somalia
before. I was in Somalia. I was traveling with U.S.-funded warlords in Somalia. And when I was there, I revealed the existence of a CIA base at the airport in Mogadishu, where they were training and paying local Somalis to go out and hunt down members of al-Shabaab. They're literally lining them up and paying them in cash, $200 each a month.
Although sometimes the warlords become our enemies,
right.
So we fund them for a while, and then we fund other people to try to kill them.
Yeah, I mean this one warlord whose story I tell in the book, he's a recurring character named Inda Ade, started off as an ally of Al Qaeda and was giving shelter to the men that had bombed the U.S. embassies in Kenya and Tanzania in 1998. Fast forward to today, and he walks around with a Somali army uniform with three stars on it, and is on the U.S. payroll fighting against those guys. So, money talks a lot, and I think certainly in Somalia.
A good portion of your book focuses on Anwar al-Awlaki, who was killed in a U.S. drone strike in 2011. A decade before he was killed, hadn't al-Awlaki been seen as a moderate figure?
He was on Talk of the Nation. On NPR. Ray Suarez interviewed him, and he was on PBS, on the NewsHour. He was profiled by the Washington Post and was portrayed in the aftermath of the attacks as a moderate imam.
No, he was not on the show. I should point that out.
Leonard, I mean, I think you're going to probably need to check your archives what made it fascinating is I remember I was working as a radio producer at the time, and I remember trying to book him because I had seen him on these other shows. And because what he was saying was, we denounce al-Qaeda. They've perverted our religion. But at the same time, we as Muslims don't want to be collectively punished. And that's why he became a kind of media superstar right after 9/11. He was a mosque imam at a mosque in Virginia.
So what radicalized him, do we know?
You know, I got to know his family well. They are not anything that you would call radicals. They weren't particularly religiously zealous. And they raised him to really admire the United States, and as they admire the United States. I think that Anwar al-Awlaki is a product of the post-9/11 response abroad and at home. And I think he was radicalized by the wars at home and abroad.
And had he became a target of a drone strike. Had he been implicated in any terrorist plot at the time of his death?
There's a lot of smoke around Anwar al-Awlaki. I mean, you know, he had praised the Fort Hood shooting that Nidal Hassan, you know, committed this massacre at Fort Hood, had been in touch with him by email, but U.S. intelligence determined al-Awlaki didn't have anything to do with it. But he wrote a blog post the next day saying Nidal Hassan is a hero. Then the underwear bomber tries to take down the plane on Christmas Day 2009. It turned out al-Awlaki had met with him. And al-Awlaki was openly calling for violent attacks against the U.S., but no evidence was ever presented that he was an operational figure.
So, now, he had created Inspire, the al-Qaeda magazine.
I don't know that he created it. He most certainly wrote for Inspire. The editor-in-chief, my understanding is the editor-in-chief of Inspire was another American, Pakistani-American named Samir Khan, who had traveled to Yemen, hooked up with al-Awlaki, and Khan, it was the editor of this publication. Al-Awlaki wrote an article in its inaugural issue.
And now it's being alleged that Inspire, this magazine, is where the Boston Marathon bombers got their recipes for their explosive devices.
Yeah, I saw this story they did on CNN today where they were saying, you know, from the grave, you know, cleric continues to impact these things. It's like zombie al-Awlaki or something. But the fact is that, you know, Anwar al-Awlaki, his sermons were very popular throughout the English-speaking world. And in a lot of terror investigations, the FBI and other entities have tried to say that al-Awlaki influenced the shooters. I just think it's very important that we not jump to conclusions about Boston, because remember what happened after the bin Laden raid. Almost everything John Brennan said happened in that room was turned out to be false later. So we as journalists need to take a step back and really learn from our mistakes.
There was bipartisan agreement that killing Anwar al-Awlaki was a good thing.
Yeah.
Despite the fact that he was a U.S. citizen. And earlier this year, there was an uproar over the release of a Department of Justice white paper which lays out the legal case for targeting the killing of U.S. citizens. Do you have a sense that these practices are now fairly institutionalized?
I think that, you know, the Obama administration, under Obama, John Brennan and other officials, who's now the CIA director, have created something called the disposition matrix, where they're essentially trying to create an algorithm for determining who can be captured and who can be killed. And this is going to be one of the enduring legacies on a foreign policy level of the Obama era, is that he really has kind of solidified and mainstreamed assassination as a central component of U.S. national security policy.
We don't have much time, and we haven't covered everything I wanted to talk about. There's a film.
We can do a speed round if you want.
Part of the film and the book focuses on the killing of Mohammed Daoud in a nighttime raid by U.S. forces. What happened there?
This was in February of 2010. A JSOC team had intelligence that there was a Taliban stronghold in this compound in Gardez, Afghanistan. They raid the place, end up killing a number of people, including two pregnant women and a senior Afghan police commander. Instead of realizing that they had been fed bad intel and kind of owning it, they dig the bullets out of the women's bodies and then blame it on the Taliban, and then blamed it on honor killing, saying that their own family members had killed them. And eventually, Admiral McRaven was forced to acknowledge that it was his forces that had done this raid. And that's the opening story of our film.
Now, former Vice President Dick Cheney and other former Bush administration officials have criticized President Obama, saying his policies have made us less safe.
Yeah. President Obama has been able to continue policies that John McCain would not have been able to continue. I think somewhere in the deep recesses of his ranch in Wyoming, Cheney is looking admirably upon some of Obama's policies.
And near the end of your book, you ask whether our counterterrorism policies are eliminating more enemies than they're inspiring. Have you been able to come up with an answer?
I don't think there's any doubt that that's true in many Muslim countries where we've been bombing. I think in Pakistan, it's indisputably true, Yemen and Somalia.
When he came to office, President Obama declared the end of secret CIA black sites. Has that been
returned to the Clinton era on steroids. Clinton started the rendition program, and Clinton liked to use people like Hosni Mubarak in Egypt and have his intelligence agents interrogate people so we could say we're not torturing. President Obama is doing that as well. And, you know, I discovered one prison in Somalia the U.S. is using, and it's certainly true that we're rendering suspects still.
Jeremy Scahill will be giving a talk and signing books tonight at 8 o'clock, at 6 o'clock, at the Barnes & Noble store in Tribeca. That's at Warren and Greenwich Street. And his documentary, Dirty Wars, will be opening June 7th at the IFC Center and the Lincoln Plaza. The book, Dirty Wars, The World is a Battlefield, is published by Nation Books. And Jeremy, it's always a bit scary, but a pleasure to have you as a guest on this show. Thank you so much for having been here.
Thanks, Leonard, and keep up the great work.